countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, looking ahead to crunch cap talks, protecting the marine ecosystem around Ireland's coastline, on the fifth anniversary of Brexit, how it's impacting on northern food producers, and Brenda sets up stall selling strawberries.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie, and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first,
van wat zij meen dat in de komende 10 jaar moet gebeuren in de Europese landen.
On June 12, 1962, the Common Agricultural Policy was born. In post-war Europe, food was scarce, and so the Treaty of Rome, which created what is now the EU, set about a process of ensuring its citizens a safe, secure supply of affordable food. Increasing productivity, securing a standard of living for farmers, stabilising markets, and providing reasonably priced food for consumers was its remit, under the watch of its undisputed founding father, Sico Mansholt, the first agricultural commissioner. Market supports encouraged production, but by the 1970s it had become a victim of its own success. Some three quarters of the community's total budget was now being spent on the cap, which was facilitating the overproduction of food. Wine lakes and butter mountains were created.
Last week's round of world trade talks, the European community came in for relentless criticism for how it subsidises its farmers through its much discredited common agriculture policy.
In 1992, Ray McSharry was the agricultural commissioner, and his reforms to balance production were seen as a radical shake-up which began the shaping of a new look cap.
Nobody can tolerate a situation where you have 80% of the support going to 20% of the producers. That just won't be tolerated anymore. That has led to this huge surplus production that has caused us difficulty internally, budgetly, and of course on the international stage, as well as the fact that in the last 20 years, half of the farmers of Europe left the land. We want to try and halt that decline, and the only way we can do it is by reorientating that support.
Further reforms took place in the early noughties, breaking the link between payments and production under the commissionership of Franz Fischler.
Our reforms are also altogether a kind of process with different steps.
Decoupling would see farmers paid a flat rate per hectare based on their average historical payments from 2000 through to 2002.
And also we have to look at incomes of our farming families.
It would also divide payments into two pillars: direct payments for farmers, and pillar two, rural development payments.
The common bit of the policy is because all of the rules for all of the EU member states are set right here in Brussels. It's one of the few policies where the EU has full control.
Indeed, over three decades, CAP has gradually undergone a transformation, focusing more on accountability for non-primary food production, such as environmental protection and animal welfare. It costs about 60 billion euros annually to fund, or 30 cents per EU taxpayer per day.
This policy is proving increasingly controversial. That's why the EU has launched a comprehensive reform of its flagship programme in a bid to make it greener and more efficient.
The latest reform proposes to link direct payments to stricter environmental compliance, while also bringing the average payment per hectare closer to the middle. This means farmers who have been getting those higher per hectare payments linked to their farm production back in 2000 to 2002 will see these supports cut, and farms where payments are lower due to lower production back in those reference years will see their payments gradually increase in what's called convergence.
President of the IFA, Tim Cullinan.
If we keep redistributing this money, more farmers will become unviable.
We're calling in this CAP reform a fairer model for all farmers.
This has caused division among farmers and politicians. The current proposal is for 85% convergence, but MEPs and farmers on lower payments want full 100% convergence, bringing everybody to the same payment per hectare by 2026. This includes the Irish Natura and Hill Farmers Association, whose president is Colm O'Donnell.
There again, all farms are different. There's extensive and intensive farming systems. All citizens of the EU have a legitimate right and expectation to be called a farmer if they have a bit of land and they're in a position to carry out an agricultural activity on that land. And we need in this CAP reform to finally acknowledge that it's about more than kilos of meat here. It's about public goods and the ecosystem services that a lot of our environmentally sensitive land provides, and an acknowledgement of that. And I think in defining what's an agricultural activity needs to encompass that this time round. What's subject to convergence is the basic income support. So it's a basic income support for sustainability, and all farms should be getting that at an equal rate. And, you know, if farmers throughout the length and breadth of the country are to benefit from it, that's what we're about.
Colm O'Donnell, the president of the Irish Natura and Hill Farmers Association, there explaining why his members want this flat rate distribution of direct payments per hectare for all farmers rather than the 75% convergence on the table at the moment. Now, in a statement, the IFA, the Irish Farmers Association, said deeper convergence would have a devastating impact on farmers with relatively small land holdings but higher than average per hectare entitlements. This would threaten the ongoing viability of large number of farmers, which would have a significant knock-on impact for the wider rural economy. Joining me now on the line is Alan Matthews, Professor of European Agriculture at the Department of Economics in Trinity College Dublin. Professor Matthews, good morning to you again.
And good morning to you, Damien.
The new CAP is all but signed off, and there are a few stumbling blocks, though, ahead of a meeting of ministers next week in Brussels. Is that the case?
Yes, there are still several issues outstanding from the so-called jumbo trilogues that failed to arrive at an agreement at the end of last month. And you've highlighted two of them in your introduction there, Damien. The first is how far should we go with the targeting of direct payments? In your opening clip, you actually referenced Ray McSherry's famous comment that it's unsustainable that 20%, that 80% of the payments go to just 20% of farmers. And actually, even since that time in 1992, that distribution hasn't actually really changed at the European level. So there's another attempt this time to try to equalise payments across farmers and to shift more of those payments towards smaller farms. So the internal convergence issue, that is the equalisation of payments across each hectare of land, and the extent to which we should go to full equalisation, 100%, or hold it at, let's say, 85%. In other words, that all farmers would be brought up to at least 85% of the average rather than the 100%. That is still an open issue for the end of this month. The other issue is, as you rightly highlighted, the fact that the CAP has focused increasingly on environmental and climate objectives. And there remains a debate about how ambitious the next CAP should be to raise its level of ambition in these areas, and that has to do with two main areas. One is the mandatory requirements that all farmers must observe if they want to be eligible for direct payments. And the outstanding issues here really relate more to the crop sector, to tillage farmers. Not so important in Ireland, but obviously to tillage farmers, they will be important. It's to do with whether they will be obliged to have crop rotation, how much of their land they should set aside for non-productive areas and so on. But the more important issue is probably the share of the overall CAP payments, both in the Pillar 1, that's the direct payments, but also the Pillar 2, which is the Rural Development Programme. How large a share of those payments should be allocated to environmental and climate measures? So that's the other major issue that's outstanding for the end of this month.
And are there enough policy tools in the new package to encourage and support, you know, Irish livestock farmers in realistically meeting climate targets while also protecting their livelihoods? Because At the moment, I think the proposal is about 30% of their direct payments will be ring-fenced and will be contingent on them implementing ecosystem-type farming on their land. That would be, is that the equivalent of you or I, 30% of our salary be conditional on us implementing ecologically beneficial work on a daily or weekly basis?
Well, that's a good analogy, Damon. It looks like the figure will arrive, end up closer to 25% as the minimum requirement. But we have to bear in mind the context here. We have been paying farmers all along to produce food, and indeed they do that excellently and high quality food at that. But we have ignored the environmental side effects of this food production. And we've seen a number of important reports, both internationally in terms of climate change and biodiversity loss, but also nationally and at European level. These environmental damages, if you like, arising from agricultural production can no longer be ignored. So the Green Deal, which was proposed by the new Commission at the end of 2019, sets out a direction, a strategy to try to ensure that agricultural production in Europe, including Ireland, of course, becomes more sustainable. And farmers need support to in that direction. So I think it makes huge sense to use a share of our CAP funding. And in fact, I would say, Damien, that we should go beyond the 25%, because in Ireland, our environmental indicators, unfortunately, are all going in the wrong direction. You know, greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture are not stable. They're not falling. They're increasing. Our ammonia emissions are above our legal limits. Our biodiversity is declining. Our bee numbers, the number of birds on the red list is increasing, and water quality, particularly in the more intensively farmed areas in the south and the east, is falling. So there's a huge challenge to be met, and we have an opportunity now when we draw up our so-called National CAP Strategic Plan, which will come into force from the beginning of 2023. So that's going to set out how we in Ireland are going to use the 1.8 billion euros that we get annually through the CAP. And we should ensure that we, as much as possible, target those payments and make effective use to help farmers in that transition to more sustainable agricultural production.
Supporting CAP, it's relatively cheap, a few euro to us taxpayers per week. But are we getting value for money finally, Alan?
Well, in my view, we could be making, as I said, a much more effective use of the very significant transfers that come in. And, you know, we should also bear in mind that the government has promised additional resources on top of the CAP from the carbon tax revenue, for example, 1.5 billion over the coming years, in addition to CAP funding, again, to help farmers to meet, what are undoubted challenges in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, as well as protecting biodiversity and water quality. So I think we have an opportunity to make, you know, more effective use of those resources than we have been doing to date. We've had agri-environment schemes, of course, GLOS, which has had some benefits in terms of biodiversity. We see that, but it hasn't had any impact on those greenhouse gas emissions, which, as I say, continue to increase. And we do need, we have very ambitious national targets being set in this climate bill, which was passed by the Dáil earlier in the week. So the challenges facing agriculture are indeed partly economic, mm-hmm. but they are also increasingly environmental. And we need to ensure that, you know, both of these objectives are addressed in the new CAP strategic plan.
It can be a quite discombobulating subject to discuss, but a very, very important one for us all, because, of course, it also amounts to us being able to avail of a cheap local food as well. But a lot of challenges ahead. As always, Professor Alan Mann, Matthews of Trinity College. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. It's hard to believe, but next Wednesday is the fifth anniversary of that Brexit referendum. It seems like only yesterday, and also it seems like a lifetime ago. Now, the news headlines this week are all about sausage wars, political resignation, nations and leadership elections, reminding us of the destabilising impact on Northern Ireland of this political change. And indeed, we heard in the news there more of that overnight. Only one thing is sure. These are uncertain times. And this week, Suzanne Campbell has been taking a snapshot of the impact on farmers and food producers in the north. Suzanne, good morning to you.
Good morning to you. Yes, Damien, there's so much news coming out of the north so quickly at the moment. And sadly, it is centred around political instability. You know, Edwin Poots resigned there after just 21 days as leader of the DUP. And the north has this fabulous opportunity to sell into Europe, to sell into the Republic of Ireland, and potentially to sell to Britain seamlessly as well. But that's not working very well as the protocol is designed at the moment, particularly with goods coming from GB into Northern Ireland. Now, we've also seen the north hit by the pandemic. You know, shops and town centres, retail in footfall in 2020 has gone down by 20%. Prices of everything, just about everything in the north, have risen. Particularly affecting farmers are the three Fs: feed, fertiliser and fuel. To everyone I talked to this week, all of which have gone up in price. And both Brexit and the pandemic, of course, are blamed for this. Building materials are in short supply, as down here as well, similar situation, more expensive if you're doing work on your farm. And also in the north, then, the UK-Australian trade deal, which has been heavily flagged, has also put farmers on edge, particularly in regard to sheep meat and beef, coming in, you know, with lesser standards of production as it stands at the moment, into their main export market, which is the UK. Now, Aidan Connolly is the head of Northern Ireland's Retail Consortium, and I asked him how businesses are faring in particular, and especially which changes in the grace period coming to an end on July the 1st, where products coming into Northern Ireland and leaving will be subject to more checks and costs, and of course the potential bans on certain foods coming in from the UK, sausages being the notorious one.
Well, we have managed to keep things afloat. There were people at the start of the year who said Northern Ireland was starving. That wasn't true. There were people who were saying that it was absolutely perfect. That wasn't true. There's an average of 40,000 or 50,000 product lines in the average supermarket. There was only ever a few hundred missing. So Northern Ireland was never starving. And nor will we be if the ban on sausages comes in on the 1st of July. We have plenty of sausages here in Northern Ireland. I think it's to do with choice, though. There's going to be less choice. And it is a great sort of forebearer of what happens on the 1st of October. On the 1st of October, we have export health certificates. We have different checks comes in. Phyto certificates on plant matter. We've even got organic certificates on organic foods as well. All those are friction, all those are costly, and that's the real worry for us, that we won't be able to give the same affordability to Northern Ireland consumers who have half the discretionary income of Great British households.
Half the discretionary income, really?
Yeah, so that means after all your big bills are paid, your rent, your mortgage, and your electricity, we have here in Northern Ireland somewhere around about £118 left per week, whereas the average in the UK is somewhere around £215. So it means that we can't afford cost rises. But the retail industry can't afford it either. We're very high volume, low profit margin. And that profit margin really has been eaten into over this past year with COVID, with some big players even seeing profit margins dipping under 1% at some stage.
Right. So it's a pretty tight situation. What about the voices saying, you know, this is an opportunity for Northern Ireland farmers, producers, manufacturers to sell more to Northern Ireland consumers?
It is realistic. And it's not just Northern Ireland consumers. You've got to remember that Northern Ireland businesses have free access to the UK market as well as the European market, over 600 million people to sell into. So the only problem then is that we still need to get those ingredients in from GB and from the rest of Europe. We still need to remove those frictions of goods that are coming from GB. That means that we need a veterinary agreement, which will remove those checks and that paperwork, those export health certificates, which are very costly. Or we need a trusted trader scheme with the Green Channel, which means that we are trusted. We give evidence to the EU of how things are made, how they're being shipped and where they're being sold. And that means that they trust us to move things without having those certificates and without having that friction and that cost.
Farmers are experiencing, of course, lots of difficulties moving seeds and livestock between the UK and the North. And this is only going to get worse once the grace period of the first 6 months ends on July the 1st, which is really around the corner. Victor Chestnut is president of the Ulster Farmers Union. He's also a beef and sheep farmer. And I asked him, again, if there are opportunities for Northern Irish farmers here to supply more of their own food domestically if prices are set to rise further on products coming in from the UK.
Yes, undoubtedly there's opportunities, but we are an exporting region. We export 85% of all the produce. The UK is our main market, so any difficulties between our market and their market doesn't help us. But look, it's the symbolism of these things that is causing the community tension. When somebody goes on online to buy something and it can't be delivered to Northern Ireland, when they go to take their pet to Scotland, which is part of the same country, the symbolism of these things is causing community unrest. And we all are concerned with the history we've had here in Ireland, and we don't want to go back there. And that's what annoys me so much as to why they can't sit down and try and sort these issues out. Because in many cases, they're no risk to the European single market. Farmers have got on well traditionally in the island of Ireland in the past. We have close links. The supply chain in the island of Ireland, the agri-food industry is completely integrated. 30% of our milk goes south for processing. A good number of our lambs go south for processing. A good number of the southern pigs come north for processing. The supply chain is completely integrated, and trying to rip that apart makes no sense at all. But we do think that one of the things in our milk, we want to be classed as produce of the island of Ireland, not as mixed origin. Mixed origin is not a label that adds value to anything. We need to work smartly around these and work together. I know we in the Ulster Farmers Union have a close relationship with the Irish Farmers Association, and we talk regularly. We can see the solutions, but the political will doesn't seem to be there from either the European side or indeed the UK side to find those solutions and make them work.
But is this idea of frictionless trade, you know, is it actually possible? Is it something that can be achieved by the Brussels and London civil services? You know, just beating things out, creating a better atmosphere, you know, creating a framework for trade that helps people to actually work it out on the ground. As farmers say, they can see the solutions. Why can't civil services do that? I talked to Vivian Gravey, lecturer in European politics at Queen's University Belfast, and asked her this.
I think there is work still definitely going on, both on the UK and the EU side, to try to kind of resolve issues around the implementation of the protocol. And I think Northern Ireland has a lot of quite small farms. And so, of course, I mean, that puts added pressure on these small farms, because the bigger groups have enough staff to make sure that their paperwork will be complete and all of this. But of course, then there's a question of, like, what kind of farming do we want for Northern Ireland? Do we want a policy where only the big farmers can survive? Of course not. Mm. So I think that's where it's actually quite welcoming, I think, that we're seeing, you know, both sides, both the UK and the EU, listening to stakeholders in Northern Ireland with representation from the farming sectors about what they actually need in practice to make it work. Because of course, something that is negotiated and that could make complete legal sense, then you have to make it work in practice on the ground.
Do you think there is give way to that, that there are going to be exemptions to make these frictions easier for farmers to handle in the North?
I think we're starting to see a bit of a different language emerging from London. Requests instead of demands of Brussels, which in general we need to have. There's a lot of things that need to be hammered out in practice, and the protocol is a living document. You've got lots of different committees that can hammer this thing in practice and can also loop in the voice of stakeholders. But the problem is, if you've got a breakdown of trust between the UK and the EU is not going to want to bend over backwards for the UK, because we are talking about things that really matter for EU citizens, the quality of the food on their plate, the fact that they know it's safe to eat. And so they won't accept shortcuts on food standards.
That's Vivian Gravey, ending that report there from Suzanne Campbell.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
By the way, I should have said before the outbreak, thank you very much to Suzanne Campbell for that very detailed report there on Brexit. Now, Vice Admiral Mark Mellett is the Chief of Staff of the Irish Defence Forces, the first naval officer to hold that post. Recently, Lorna Siggins met him at Rosmoney Pier in his native Mayo, the place where he first learned to sail. Now, when we think of the climate and biodiversity issues, we think of the land of Ireland. But Vice Admiral Mellett is concerned about the impact on the seas around Ireland, and he also believes that these seas can contribute to us reaching our climate targets. There was a fierce north wind, and looking out over Clew Bay towards the Atlantic, Lorna began by asking him, when he looks out over the sea to the Atlantic, what does he see?
I see a jurisdiction where we as citizens in this state have an extraordinary privilege, an area of almost 1 million square kilometres where we have sovereignty or sovereign rights, an area which is rich in biodiversity, rich in resources. I see an area that actually, when you combine it with what we have on land, is probably the richest food producing ecosystem and renewable energy environment on the planet. And that's within the sovereign control of the Irish state. But I suppose what I also see is a historical perspective, because I was just thinking as I came in here, 450 years ago, one of the biggest actors around this area was Grainne Whale, the pirate queen. And she was challenging norms and principles at the time. She was, I suppose, retaliating against the control by the crown of this area. And at the same time, in another jurisdiction, Hugo Grotius was developing some of the principles that underpin the law of the sea as we know today, Mara Librium. It's that tension that I, throughout my life as a naval officer, have been tasked by government to navigate between the idea of enclosure, which requires restrictions, and that idea of freedom. And I always say it, whether it's on land or at sea, freedom is not free. For us to actually have a civil society, you have to conform with certain norms and principles. And so, from the point of view of what's happening now and what will happen in the future, it's going to be really down to the norms and principles that we define as society that will ensure the sustainable development of our marine resource, this extraordinary resource we have, and at the same time ensuring that we do not damage it in a manner whereby we have an intergenerational sabotage, which I'm afraid is happening as we speak. And we can see that in the evidence of climate breakdown in terms of biodiversity loss. There are really, really worrying challenges ahead of us. The impact on security on land, the impact on security in the maritime, but they also impact on our potential for survival. I can say one thing as a fact. The very reason we as a species are still alive is because of the biosphere that the ocean is. I don't think everybody recognises it, but the ocean absorbs 30% of the carbon that we produce. About another 20% is absorbed by terrestrial ecosystems, and about 50% basically just remains in the system. That's an extraordinary amount of carbon. And the penalty for the ocean is it's becoming more acidic. And I look out at the sea there, and I see some wonderful ecosystems, vulnerable marine ecosystems. Recently we've heard about the bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef, which is probably the largest living infrastructure on the planet, and it is dying because of the impact of climate change. We have rich ecosystems, vulnerable marine ecosystems in our own jurisdiction, but we don't see them. There are cold water corals, for instance, are about 600 metres down. They sit on seamounts just on the break as we go into the deep ocean from the Porcupine Bank. All along there, one of the richest areas of cold water corals in the world is off the west coast of Ireland. Beautiful, beautiful ecosystems. And because we don't see it, I don't always think that we value it. And yet it's a key part of the ecosystem that is there. The way life survives is on the basis of a balance in that ecosystem. And arresting the actual penalty of carbon absorption in the ocean is a critical piece. I suppose I have a sense of optimism, however, in terms of the government's climate action plan, which is looking towards a 51% reduction in carbon by 2030, the actual promise of 5 gigawatts of offshore renewable energy by 2030, and probably another 30 gigawatts in the years that follow. You know, people don't realise what 5 gigawatts of energy is. It's nearly 60 Ardna Crushes. It's just phenomenal what is potentially going to unfold in front of us. a huge opportunity in terms of technology, in terms of innovation. And so if this goes in the right direction, if we move to that 51% by 2030 and carbon zero by 2050 and beyond, we have a real chance of arresting the penalty in terms of our arrogance in terms of the environment up to now. And we will arrest that danger of intergenerational sabotage, because this generation is actually robbing from future generations in the way it's utilising resources as if there is no tomorrow.
So when you look out at Ireland's wonderful big blue field out there, you see nightmarish storms ahead.
You know, I'm an optimist, and I hate the word nightmare, because I think just if we drop our heads and look at it from a nightmare scenario point of view, we could tend to lose hope. The world as we know it, and the Earth as a planet, has gone through five main extinction periods in the past. And I often look back and I wonder, you know, what do the reptiles and the dinosaurs think about it, you know, in terms of their imminent doom? Well, first of all, they probably didn't know it was coming, and even if they did, they couldn't do anything about it. The difference today is we have an extraordinary intelligence in terms of human beings, and we've made extraordinary growth in terms of the growth of technology, in growth of artificial intelligence, intelligence augmentation, virtual reality, Internet of Things, robotics, automation. There is a huge opportunity for us with our intelligence to be able to address the challenges that are ahead of us. The only way, however, is through a multilateral framework. But not just in terms of state working with state, this has to pepper back down into organisations that they themselves look at their own strategies in the context of how they're embracing the Sustainable Development Goals. And then it comes right back to us as individuals and our values and the way we actually make decisions with regards to, do we need to buy that fruit that has been flown halfway around the world, or will we make do with local produce and help local enterprise in your area? That's the decisions we have. They're the choices we will make. And I think those people are beginning to become alert to that now in terms of what we can do ourselves, starting as individuals, then within our families and our organisations, and driving that right up to state level. So, as we look forward to where we are here beside the sea, the whole idea of the Maritime Area Regulatory Authority, which will be part of the Maritime Area Planning Framework, which is legislation that will actually oversee the governance of the ocean and the maritime, so that we can actually ensure that these renewable energy installations can be built, you know, in a manner whereby there is norms and principles and regulatory oversight, and at the same time that the environment itself is also being protected. And I think one of the big challenges ahead will be to look at greater marine protected areas in areas off the west coast here. And I think one of the big challenges ahead will be to look at greater marine protected areas in areas off the west coast here. And it's not all, you know, negative in terms of a marine protected area. You get spillover on the boundaries, which actually can be a very rich fishery. So I have a sense of optimism. What doesn't get measured doesn't get done. So setting targets like 51% by 2030 is very ambitious, but it is a target, so let's get measuring towards it. And the idea of zero carbon by 2050 is actually essential if we're to arrest the general growth in global temperatures.
And that was Vice Admiral Mark Mellett speaking to Lorna Siggins, and they spoke for longer on that, and it was a wide-ranging conversation, which we will put up on our website after the programme. Well, now that we're free to travel across the country, if you're out on the road this weekend, you'll probably spot a real sign of summer. That is, strawberries being sold along the roadside. These strawberry stalls are amongst the thousands of seasonal workers involved in the strawberry industry. Brenda Donoghue became one of them for a while this week. She joins me in studio. Brenda, you were selling strawberries along the side of the road.
I certainly was. Good morning, Damien. Do you know what? I absolutely loved it. I think I have found my calling. So basically, I suppose we all see them on the side of the road now. And I was at the Whitford roundabout just outside Wexford. I set my stall there, and I was with a lovely student. She's studying pharmacy in Trinity, Cuiva Kerwin, and she was selling the strawberries there. And she starts at 8 in the morning and she finishes at 6 that evening. And what was so interesting were the people stopping and the reasons they were getting their strawberries. And it's set on a little height, so you can kind of look at the cars coming in and out. Now, I talk to lots of people. It's very noisy because we're just on the side right of a motorway. But you really got a sense of Ireland on the move as it is now, from people who are reuniting to staycationers to your regulars. And there's a real ebb and flow to the day in terms of the sales. But I started off with Cuiva first thing in the morning and I met some amazing people. Let's have a listen.
Morning, Brenda. I'm just getting set up here today. It's going to be a busy one since it's a lovely day.
Two cars there, I better let you go and see what they want.
Yeah. Now, sir, here are your strawberries.
Yeah, no butters.
Morning, sir. What's your name?
My name is Thomas McCarty. I'm from Kilteely. Yeah. And I'm down this morning on dialysis.
Right.
And so I'm finished there now and I'm on my way home now. And I'm going to eat a couple of strawberries on the way home.
And how long are you on dialysis?
Yeah, 3 times a week and for about three to four hours.
And was it a shock to go on it in the first place?
It is a big shock in the sense you're losing a certain amount of freedom and wanting another. You don't realise what the kidneys are doing until you have it, until they're not doing it.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of issues with potassium and different salts in the body and all that type of thing. It's a learning curve, you know, that way.
I do.
After having dialysis, it is nice to get the fresh Wexford strawberries. You can't have better. And it's my little treat in the car home.
That's a large punnet of strawberries. You all look like you're going on a road trip, are you?
Yeah, we're going up to Dublin Zoo to see our cousins from California. We're just bringing them up as a present because we haven't seen them in like 4 years. So it'll be nice to just bring a bit of Wexford up to them. So,
Dad, you're a chauffeur.
I'm just told what to do.
It's a big deal, isn't it, taking them up? Can you give me a little bit of the background?
We're going to see our cousins who, their mom passed away. The cousin's mom passed away in November. Carol, so we're going to see my brother and the two kids. Now, the two kids are the same age as these guys. Mm. So, it's nice just to hang out, get to know each other again, because they haven't seen each other for quite a while, you know, and then it's been a sad year for the cousins.
Of course, and you wouldn't have been able to go to your sister-in-law's funeral.
No, the funeral was on the iPad, so that was awful. I mean, it's a long distance anyway, San Francisco, but one of us would have gone over to something like that at least. You know, we're a big family of 8. It was very sad doing it on the iPad. And they had a beautiful service. They carried it off very nicely. Carol Curtin, that's who passed away.
Shane, I'm just grasping this story here. This will be your first time seeing your brother since his wife died.
Yes,
goodness, yeah.
Carol was a beautiful girl, really great. You know, you enjoy being in her company. She was really good fun, really calm, and she's, you know, yeah, she was great fun. And look, it's only been phone contact once every couple of weeks since November, really, and delighted he came home.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, we only stopped to get strawberries, but here we are now, yeah, we're on the radio. Great.
Good morning. These ones here are €10 each and they'll keep you going for a while.
Hi, what's your name?
Kira Gann.
Do you mind me saying straight away you're with child?
I am. Yeah.
What are you getting the strawberries for?
A couple of my friends are coming to celebrate the bump with some strawberries and ice cream in the afternoon.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah. It's been very hard, and especially now that I'm pregnant, I can't mix unless it's outdoors, so it's really weather dependent, but I suppose just try and make the most of it then when it is fine and get out. Really looking forward to the new baby coming now in a couple of months.
Lovely, happy variety of people passing through there. Did it quieten down in the afternoon, Brenda?
Yeah, it's funny. It's really busy in the morning. Lots of regulars, lots of people en route to and from their destinations. But the afternoon's a little bit quieter. And on a kind of very wet Wednesday, Cuiva tells me she likes to put Netflix on her phone. So often you see them with the headphones on as you drive past. But she sells on average 200 to 300 punnets a day, depending on the weather more than anything. And her stand is one of 20 spread across 11 counties run by Greenhill Fruit Farm. The owner and manager is Eamon Crean, and he stopped by very kindly with an ice cream for myself and Cuiva. And I talked to Eamon about, you know, were there strawberries in his family when he was growing up? Was this part of his background?
So my mother's father, Tom English, grew strawberries in 1940s. And then my mother went on to marry a dairy farmer. So the culture then obviously broke for a couple of years. And then as I became a dairy farmer's son, there was 2 sons and 1 farm. We got paid very little wages, enough to go out one night instead of 2. So I had to think outside the box and come up with some solution to get out a few more nights. So start buying fruit off my uncle. We went up to the Midlands and start selling fruit. And you know, Brenda, you know, luckily for me, social life got much better with better finance. And I went down to the Bridge nightclub. I met my wife. You know, we went off and done the stands together. And as we were doing as a couple, she supported me, I supported her. And it kept us very united it's 30 years now down the line. That gave us the magic to keep going each day.
Well, there you go. That's Eamon. And by the way, his wife is called Deirdre. So back, Damien, to talking to the customers again as the day drew to a close. And I met Lynn. Now, Lynn is originally from Wales, but he settled in Ireland over 40 years. He met his wife. He was over for an Ireland-Wales rugby match. He was on the way back to the ferry, stopped in the pub in Rosslare, met the wife. She drove him to the ferry. He just about made it. Said that was it. Love at first sight. Came back and is living in Ireland for the last 42 years. But as I was letting him go, I noticed something interesting in the back seat of his car.
If you don't mind me saying, I just see in the back of your car there, are they pigeons?
They are, racing pigeons. We race them every week and these are getting exercise now, ready to go to Scotland next week.
What is the bug? What's the buzz of the raising buzz, them?
Getting the bird fit and seeing them coming home after 11, 12 hours flying. Coming home to you and into the loft, it's exciting then.
And when's your next race?
A week Saturday from Perth in Scotland.
Do you send the pigeon from here to Scotland or do you go? What way does it work?
It's a national race and they all get collected by a proper transporter. And then they go up to Scotland and they're released then by two men that's with them.
And they make the way back to you.
And then you've got to clock them in then. Amazing. Right down to the last yard, yeah. You lose a good few through. The Peregrine Falcon is the main problem. He's devastating the racing pigeons anyway.
You have opened up a whole new world to me. Thank you so much. And enjoy
welcome.
Racing the pigeons.
Right, I will do.
What have you bought there, sir?
Strawberry.
Where are you from?
Romania.
And what are you doing today? What's your job? You're obviously working.
I'm a truck driver.
And what are we delivering to and from?
Frozen meat.
Yeah?
Everything. What's in the fridge.
Yeah. How long are you in Ireland and how have you found it so far?
I have 7 years working here.
And have you family back home in Romania?
Yes, I have. One boy and one girl.
Has it been difficult not being able to see them?
I don't want to think about it. Yeah. If I think about it, it's very hard for me to work and after that.
You must miss them very much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very much. But for them I work. Better life for my children.
Well, look, enjoy your strawberries on the road.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm just finishing up for the day here now, getting my fruit ready to go. Now just about to close up the shutter and that's me done for another day.
Well, Brenda, I'll tell you one thing. It sounds as if you really enjoyed yourself. And I presume you brought me back a few punnets.
Of course I did. They've gone off now, though, because it was a few days ago. But a great time. And thank you, Caoimhe, for letting me spend the day with you on the strawberry stand just outside Wexford. I loved it.
Strawberry fields forever. Brenda Donoghue, thank you very much. You have your calling. If the broadcasting doesn't work out, we know where to find you in the future.
Very likely.
That's all we have time for this week in Countrywide. Brian Moss was our broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound and Eileen Heron produced. Coming up after the 9 news here on Radio 1, it's Playback. But until I talk to you at the same time next week, enjoy the strawberries. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.